Hi, if I could take a moment of your time before we start, if you've enjoyed previous episodes or if you enjoy this episode, if you could subscribe on the platform that you listen to, that would be really helpful. It helps us get more guests and push the podcast forward. Thanks.
There's never been a faster or easier way to start your weight loss journey than with PlushCare. PlushCare accepts most insurance plans and gives you online access to board-certified physicians who can prescribe FDA-approved weight loss medications like Wegovy and Zepbound for those who qualify. Take charge of your health and speak with a board-certified physician about a weight loss plan that's right for you. Get started today at PlushCare.com/weightloss. That's PlushCare.com/weightloss. PlushCare.com/weightloss.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hi everyone, welcome to the Car Chat podcast, and with us today we have David Brown. Hello.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Can you tell the audience a little bit about who you are, what you do?
I can indeed, yeah. My name is the same as my father's name. He was also a David Brown, and I started off my working life by working in a family firm building earth-moving equipment. So we built very big off-highway dump trucks. My father's name and my name, very similar to a man also called David Brown who started Aston Martin, but no relation whatsoever. Okay. At one stage, he and my father, the David Brown from Aston Martin, and my father, the David Brown from me, they were actually good friends, and in fact, they both at one stage were building tractors, competitive tractors.
Oh, okay.
So, I started my working life off in very heavy engineering business, building off-highway articulated dump trucks, which are a massive thing, really. The biggest one we made weighed, when it was fully laden, about 100 tons. So some big pieces of kit, really. Those businesses did extremely well. And we always felt we were inventing a product to solve a problem the customer didn't know he had. So in other words, this was a new way of doing things with a new piece of equipment. Mm. And in that regard, it was people shifted dirt, so muck shifters, they had ways of doing it that had been around for almost ever since the horse and cart. And we developed a product that allowed them to do it a different way. That product is now used throughout the world. There's tens of thousands of them now having been built and used throughout the world to do a job in a very efficient way. Having started that company with my father, I sold the company to Caterpillar started quite a few other different businesses as a consequence, and they were almost lifestyle businesses.
Yeah.
And those businesses, I had some clothes shops, some ladies' shoe shops, some restaurants, some bars, house building company. So I started all these other businesses almost immediately after selling that company. That put me into the lifestyle section of life. something I hadn't really been in before. And so when it came to starting David Brown Automotive, I had two sets of experiences and skills that, when blended together, ended up with the products that we now have. So first of all, manufacturing, making something, was not something that worried me in the slightest. So people today will still say, you know, how on earth do you go about making a car? And I have to think of it from their perspective, and their perspective is, we don't know, you know, we've no idea how you go about making a car. I do.
Yeah.
And the other side, which was the lifestyle businesses, was all about style, taste, the fashion side of business, which were then able to blend together to produce the cars we do today.
Yeah. Well, that sounds like a nice mix. And had you always had a passion for cars throughout this time?
Yeah. When I was younger, like everyone who likes cars when they're younger, I would customize a car to a certain extent. And in those days, you know, the first thing you did when you bought any car was to go and buy a proper radio for it and big speakers and hide some amplifiers. But I had one of the first Range Rovers, which was a hand-me-down from my father. And I remember turbocharging that before cars were really turbocharged, customizing the interior, adding an extra gearbox to it. So it had 16 forward speeds, and which if you were ever wanted to impress someone, you'd run through each gear on the way up the gearbox.
Yeah.
Only took about a quarter of an hour to get the top. But, always interested in cars. And at various stages, I built my own rally car. So I loved rally driving, but I got into that quite late on. But then built the cars that I rallied with help. I won the Group N Championship in a Subaru. And,
awesome.
And then built a world rally car based on Ford Escort parts, but a Ford Puma shell, because I just thought it looked better, and rallied that successfully as well. So interested in cars, still interested in all sorts of cars. I have an old AC, 1937, which I've used on some endurance rallies relatively recently. So I've done the Peking to Paris rally, for example.
Oh, wow. What is that like? Because that sounds amazing.
Okay, so I did that in a 1927 Rolls-Royce Phantom II that belonged to a friend. And at the start of it in Peking, or Beijing, we would have won the prize for the most unsuitable car on the rally, without a shadow of a doubt. But when... five, six, however many weeks later it was, and we drove down the Champs-Élysées into the centre of Paris, we should have won a prize for the most successful crossing of a continent ever.
Hmm.
It broke down every single solitary day. And there wasn't anything that didn't go wrong on it. And every day you just end up underneath the car at the end of the day, absolutely filthy, tired out, and trying to fix something yet again on it, to put it right.
Mm.
But as an experience, it was fantastic. You know, you go to some places that you will never, ever go back to. There's no reason to go back to them. And yeah. Similarly, in my AC, I've done the Singapore up through Malaysia, Thailand, and into Burma up into Mandalay, and then across South America as well. Argentina, Chile, and Peru. They're fantastic. You know, I love, fortunately, driving. And so every day, every time you're out driving, you're still practicing a skill. You know, you would try and take the racing line through a forest, you know, at 100 miles an hour with trees either side. You're desperate to try and find that line all the time.
Yeah.
So yeah, I enjoy driving.
That's those trips. I mean, they sound absolutely amazing. And doing it in something old must add a lot to the experience versus doing it, you know, like a modern Range Rover.
Oh, it massively does. And, you know, one of the reasons I enjoy driving my AC is that you really do feel every little thing. You know, you smell the smells from the outside. Driving from when I got to Paris on the Peking to Paris rally, I didn't want to get a plane home. So I got a lift back from Paris with one of the mechanics in his van to, I think it was Oxford Services, where I got someone to pick me up and pick me up in my Range Rover. And I got into the Range Rover, and I love my Range Rover. It's a fantastic car. But I got into it and I didn't like it because it was too refined. You know, it was too, everything about it was like a sofa on wheels. And having spent, traveled all that distance, literally smelling, you know, the roses you drove past somewhere or the dead dog in the ditch, whatever it was, you were in touch with it. And in touch through the steering wheel, in touch through literally the smells I can remember so very, very much. And we used to refer to the AC as the comfort capsule because it's a tiny little car. You get into this thing and you're like that. I've done thousands and thousands of miles in it across all sorts of different terrain. Fantastic.
It sounds like the best. And absolutely, like that point you said about the smells, like I kind of forget about that now, but because I don't drive cars without the roof on very often, or I don't have a convertible, but every now and then I'll borrow something or drive something, whether it's a Caterham or something like that. And you do, like, you drive down a country lane and it's just like, it just hits you, like leaves and forest and all that stuff, and it just adds so much.
No, it really does. It really does. It adds to the sensation of where you are. It's excellent.
And driving through all of those countries, like, did you end up in some pretty, like, sticky situations at any point, or was it relatively okay?
No, I think that I can't remember a single place where I felt uncomfortable. I remember crossing from Mongolia into Russia. And there's a region called the Altai region in which borders, it's like the bottom end of Siberia, touches Mongolia. And that was one of the most stunning places I'd been to. And the local car clubs, they all came out to meet us and greet us. And if you needed anything doing, there was somebody there, and I can't remember what car it was now, but the engine needed to come out. And no sooner have they got in the car park than all the locals were underneath it. They had the engine lifted out of it on a piece of wooden some chains within about literally 10 minutes, you know, it was out. And so everywhere people love to see old cars, and they're fascinated by it, you know. And in certain areas, you know, bits of China, they wouldn't thank you for an old car. You know, they've gone through 50, 60, 70 years of old cars. All they want now is a Toyota Land Cruiser.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, that's, you know, it's different people, a different view on what life should be.
Yeah. I'd not thought about the local car clubs in those situations, because I'd sort of thought that it would just be, you'd start at one end and you'd drive to the other end and you'd deal with all the stuff in the middle. But obviously there's loads of enthusiasts in the middle who want to come and meet these people doing this trip and see what's going on and check out the cars and stuff. Would you be traveling with other, like, are you traveling with other cars, or are you generally by yourself? How does that work?
You are traveling. I mean, there's the Peking to Paris rally now probably got 120, maybe even more participants, 120 cars. So you set off at different intervals, and you always have a hotel or some accommodation or a tent that you're aiming for at nighttime. So you always try and get to the same place. But inevitably, if you have a breakdown, we had a breakdown, I can't remember what the breakdown was now, we had quite a few, on the Peking to Paris. And that meant we were a day behind. So I remember one night just sleeping outside in the Mongolian desert and being woken by an inquisitive camel first thing in the morning. And, so, But yeah, it was there's some brilliant, brilliant memories.
Yeah. Oh, it sounds super cool. So where did the idea for a, well, I guess the first car, was the first car the Speedback? That was the first car, right?
It was, yeah.
And where did the idea for that come from? And sort of how did you end up with that design and everything?
I had a DB5, Aston Martin DB5. And long before I considered making my own car. And like a lot of old cars, particularly some of the cars in the 60s, they were extremely unreliable. And and so whenever I used this car, it was with trepidation, and most times it broke down. And, you know, big things like the top hose bursting, and little things like, you know, a wire came off and the windscreen wiper stopped working, whatever it was. So always in my mind, I was going to do something with this DB5. I was actually going to put an American crate engine in and do all the electronics differently. But everyone said to me, if you do that, you'll ruin the value of it. And this was before they got silly. But so I was talked out of that. At the same time, I was on another classic car. It was more of a tour in the south of France. And a friend had loaned me a Ferrari, what was the thing? It was like a convertible. It will come to me what the name of it was. Anyway, this thing, you forgot how absolutely awful some of the cars were in that period. Again, a 1960s car. So yeah. The steering was heavy. The gearbox was awful. Anyway, mercifully, it jammed itself into second gear, and I couldn't get it out of second gear. And so I had to abandon it. And I abandoned it near Nice Airport and got a little Peugeot 205 as a hire car to continue with the rest of the rally. And you jump out of something like that fabulous Ferrari that everyone thinks is absolutely brilliant, into, you know, a cheap little hire car. And you realize how good cars had become in that period. Yeah. So it had air conditioning, it had power steering, it had a radio and things like that. And so people on the rally, and it was red hot. So people on the rally pretended they felt sorry for me. And so if you want to, you can drive our car as long as we can drive that thing over there with air conditioning.
Yeah.
And so the reality was that, you know, the cars have moved on an enormous amount. I then got, and there's all sorts of factors, but I then saw some really interesting bits of engineering going on in just in all sorts of walks of life. And you could see how with new digital technology, you could make things beautifully and accurately and repeatable. So you could make low volume parts that previously somebody had to carve by hand with a file to create the shape. So I then started thinking, maybe we should make a car that is reminiscent of the 60s, but is actually full of current and modern technology, to give you the pleasure that you would normally get from just driving a car in that way. Yeah. So that's how it started. And initially, I was just going to make the car for myself. But everybody said, it looks really, really nice. You should think about putting it into production. So that's what happened.
And that bit there, okay, in that sort of the gap between you're going to make a car for yourself and it going into production, Did you look at a bunch of different platforms as a base? Did you just go, okay, I'm going to start with something that someone else has done and then coach build my own bodywork onto it? How did that process? Did you look at a few different options and stuff like that?
Well, I think the thing was that, you know, predominantly it had to be British in its content. To make sense of what the brand stood for and still stands for, and British as well, just because I'm a proud Brit and wanted it to reflect what was happening in the UK. And so there's then very few platforms that are actually available. If you go back to the early days of car production, you would have people like Rolls-Royce and Bentley, and all they would build is a rolling chassis. Somebody else would put the bodywork on. Somebody else would trim it and do everything else. So in some respects, wanted to get back to that sort of feel. And then that narrows massively the choices you've got. But one kept standing out for a whole host of reasons, and that was that some of the Jaguar platform, largely because they're bonded aluminium sections, structures, put together. And we were going to make an aluminium body that we would bond to that. The V8 engine that's in the Speedback, supercharged engine, is, I think, one of the best V8 engines in the world. Absolutely ideal for a GT, lots of low down torque. But the, you know, discretionary performance in terms of how you choose to use it. So the decision became relatively easy.
Yeah. And then, so what's the process then? You've got a base car, which was, is it an XKR? Is that right?
XKR, yeah.
And then what? Did you design the body? Did you get someone else? How did you, okay, what were you looking for?
So we were looking to take styling cues for the car from the 60s. So all of the world's greatest, still most attractive supercars came from that period of time. And, you know, you think about the 60s in terms of what they actually were. And it was you had the problems of the 50s, where money was tight, food was tight, you know, rationing was still on. Everything was still recovering from the World War II. Then in the 60s, everything started to relax and become more available. Music, you know, just went off at a different tangent. So did sex, so did art, so did all of the things that had been constrained by the austerity of the post-war years. So the 60s produced these big, curvy machines, and most of them were styled in studios in Italy. You know, it was a relatively small handful of people that styled cars, including some of the British cars, with the exception of the E-Type. You know, they were all styled over there. And so for us to get into, we wanted to recreate that period of time. Yeah. But we didn't want a pastiche of a number of different things. We wanted a thing to sit in its own right. So the process was to do a full-size clay model of what the car would look like. And basically, we did the model in two halves. So slight changes on one side to the other. And when we decided which of the two halves we liked the best, we digitized that down the middle and flipped it across, and you've got a mirror image of what you like. But even that, you know, to create that, made it sound easy. It's not, you know, the skills involved in making the clay model are fantastic. And I had to go once and messed it up. And but I knew what I wanted. I knew the sort of look I wanted. And then you've got, you know, you've got to take account of all the packaging issues you've got, how things are actually going to fit in real life. I wanted a very usable car. If it's a GT, it's a Grand Tourer. If it's a Grand Tourer, it means you go on a journey. If you go on a journey, you take luggage. And there's so many GTs today that are not. You know, you cannot.
Most, I would say.
Yeah, you cannot get anything in them. So it becomes a, you know, something that if you want to take the wife away for the weekend, you almost can't, because you can't get the luggage in that you need. So it becomes, so to me, those cars were pointless. So it had to be practical. And so the Speedback GT is very much that. It's very much a practical piece of kit that you can use in all sorts of different ways. So once you've got the clay model looking the way you want it, digitize it, And then the hammer forms, which are the wooden insides, if you like, of the aluminium body, they are produced using five-axis CNC milling machines from the data that you've got but when you've scanned the car.
Yeah.
So to then make the body shell, you then use some really traditional skills, which is the old English wheel. So people there are rolling this material and forming the shape and then putting it onto the hammer form to make sure it is exactly the right shape. And that's basically and simply how we make the shell. Now, it sounds as if it's something you can just then just drop on the top of and a few volts and you're off, and nothing could be further from the truth. Yeah. So there's still a massive amount of work. We have things like soft close on the doors, and we have to incorporate that both mechanically into the system and electronically into the systems that we use. So we tried not to reinvent any wheels that were already there and use existing either technology or components to get us there. But at the same time, in terms of style and in terms of content, we wanted to create our own things, our own DNA, if you like, in terms of what the product looked like.
Yeah, it's when you see it, like I'll put up some images for the people watching the video and the people who are not, Google it, the Speedback GT. It's a cool looking thing. It looks, like you said, it looks kind of like something from a bygone era in terms of the design styling. But you've still got reasonably modern. Well, when did you launch the car?
8 years ago now.
Yeah. So you get in it and you've got, well, I don't know, the stuff has been upgraded now so you can have CarPlay and stuff like that, but you've got all your sort of creature comforts. But then I didn't realize this was the case. I'd seen the picture of the car from the outside, but when I went and had a look around, it's got like a little tailgate that comes down at the back. That's if you've not seen a picture, it won't make sense. But when you look at it, and then it's got a massive boot. Like, it's huge, which makes 100% sense in the it's a GT car, therefore you need to be able to put luggage in it. And then you've got, is this on all cars? Are the seats on, the fold-out seats on all the cars?
Yeah, so the rear tailgate, there is a tailgate and then the sloping roof, and the rear tailgate will fall flat and line up with the floor of the boot. Similarly with the rear seats, you don't have to have seats, but if you've got seats or little parcel shelves that we've got in some of the cars, that will fold forward and flat as well. So you've got this massive flat floored boot extending all the way. But then we had some space and we thought we can do something clever here. So we developed a little dicky seat that will fold out of there. So if you want to, if you're in the right place, you can lift that seat up and perch yourself on the back. And there's a lot of car companies doing that now. But I think we were first.
Yeah, when it got unfolded in front of me, I was just like, I did not expect that. And that is, it's really cool. It's basically, a seat, a double seat facing backwards, sitting kind of on the tailgate that folds out from the boot. And yeah, you see it in some other cars now, but it's quite a neat thing. And then I know you can customize all this stuff a lot, can't you? You can.
Yeah, we encourage people to be individual in terms of what they do. So we want people to enjoy the process of specking the car up and to realize that they can really make it a reflection of their own personality. So we've got, the answer is yes. Now, what's the question in terms of what we can do and the way we'll do it?
Yeah.
And we've thoroughly enjoyed helping people create these individual reflections of them.
What have been some of the sort of most interesting modifications or adjustments you've made to a car for a unique customer or something?
Well, We've built a number of them, but the one actually borrowed it from the customer and took it to a show at the weekend, and it was a pearlescent white car with a green leather interior, and instead of the veneers, instead of the panels on the dash and on the door cards being veneered with a high gloss finish, they were actually painted body colour. It, when he first said that that's what he wanted, it was like, I'm not quite sure what that's going to look like, but it was fantastic. And out in the sunshine, you know, that paint just sparkles. It's absolutely beautiful. So it was one of the stars of the show the other day when we took it there. It's absolutely beautiful.
And then have you done any, because you can have on the top, is it on the top of, basically, the fold-out seat folds into the boot, and then you can have other stuff sort of on it, on that area, don't you? Because I think there was like the one I saw the other day had sort of space for your whiskey and your glasses and all that sort of stuff. Have you had any funny requests there? Like, I don't know, gun lockers and whatever.
Not really. We've had all sorts of people make suggestions as to what could go in there. And but the reality is most people want something along the lines of, I think one we've just done has a bottle of Johnny Walker whiskey in there and some glasses down the side.
Yeah.
But it's, no, it's just, it the speed back is a conservative type of thing. It's not something that, it's not a flash car. It's a stunning car and looks great. But it's not flash in the sense of it being, you know, highly aggressive in terms of its styling. When we drive that car around, most of the time, we just get people doing that because as you drive past, because they just think it looks great. Never ever had a negative reaction to it, which I know you would get in some contemporary supercars. And that tends to reflect itself in the type of person the owners are. They want something special, but they don't want something, and I use the word for lack of a better one, they don't want something flash or in your face.
Yeah, I totally get that. And the sort of, I'd say the ethos of the car that I've sort of picked up by driving it is it's a GT car that has been set up to be comfy, and the suspension is comfy. And on a British B road, it is comfy. You're not having your teeth like rattled out. And it just kind of, you kind of just kind of cruise around with this nice V8 sound and get to your location. And it has a sort of, it's not a vintage experience, but there's vintage elements brought into the experience. Like you've got the wood, this one had a wooden steering wheel and stuff like that, which just sort of take you back to a slightly different era while still remaining in a modern car. I enjoyed driving it, but it was very relaxing, and I very much enjoyed that part of it.
It set out to be what it is. So it is, a certain terms of styling, different people see different things in it, depending on your frame of reference. So Americans see a muscle car element to the back end. Germans, people have seen throwbacks to some Porsches in the front. Italians, 250 short wheelbase Ferraris, British Aston Martin. But it, in its own right, it stands as a complete thing, not as a pastiche of all those things put together, but it sets out to be a genuine GT. And that was really, really important in terms of the original design and styling.
Yeah. I think that's something that is absolutely missing in a lot of modern cars, that actually being a GT car, like it actually being comfy. That everything seems to be compromised around a lap time nowadays, which doesn't really make sense for a lot of cars.
It doesn't. My daily runaround is an Audi RS3, and it has tires that are sidewall. That thick.
Yeah.
So if I hit a pothole, it will either puncture the tyre or smash the wheel, which is done on a number of occasions.
Yeah.
I wanted to put smaller wheels on it so I could get a deeper sidewall, a higher sidewall. You can't, because it's got the front brakes are so big, they'd stop a Le Mans car going down straight. They'd stop it, and it is totally the rest of the car is fantastic, but it's unnecessary. And, you know, everybody is focused on something. It's either a ridiculous horsepower number, or it's desperate to break the 300 mile an hour top speed. Where, when, how? You know, the a few years ago, I drove the speed back down to show in the south of France, and I kept getting passed by the same three Ferraris. I thought, I don't understand how they're passing me. And then I pulled into a service station at the same time they did. And the reason they were passing me is that when they got out of the car, it was like, oh, ouch. And they could only do about 70 miles before they had to get out and have a chiropractor back in place. And I get it. You know, I am massively full of admiration for the technology and a lot of the styling, but it sometimes beggars belief when this can actually be used or how it's going to be used.
Yeah.
And I'm not a big track day fan, largely because I did what I needed to do like that in rally cars in forests.
Yeah.
I don't want to go and aim for a blade of grass and aim for another blade of grass and believe that I've got the racing line just spot on like that. Our cars are not track day cars, or the speedbacks aren't.
No. No. That you've picked the purpose and the aim is to fulfill that purpose. Nothing else really. The car got a bit of an update, not necessarily an update, a styling change with these. Is it the Silverstone edition?
It is, yeah.
Can you explain to people what that is?
Yeah, so we wanted to create two different versions almost of the same thing. And so the Silverstone edition is a roarer. Doesn't have the little bumperettes on it. It has a different finish to the chrome work. It's got an engine performance enhancement. It has different suspension fitted. So it's supposed to be and is a roarer version, but a slightly faster version of the same car.
Hmm.
And different people, you know, I'm delighted that. Some people like one, some people like the other, or prefer one to the other. It was intended to, I think, a slightly younger audience as well. We were aiming for, but still, people wanted that same overall GT feel.
Yeah. When I look at the two cars, so there was, I think your car was there, which is a Silverstone edition, and. That to me is a more appealing image. Like it's just sort of smoothed out in various places, cleaned up in different ways, and like you said, the bright work is different and a different finish. It's more of like a brushed stainless kind of brush finish rather than a shiny kind of finish, and it appeals much more to me. It's amazing actually how different the two cars look next to each other. I thought it looked really cool. With the changes, and then I guess I'm a younger person, so that's possibly.
Well, some people sort of said that the Speedback GT is for a gentleman, and the Silverstone edition is for someone who is not yet ready to become a gentleman.
Fair enough.
And I think they were talking about me there, so I'm happy.
Yeah. So at some point in time, you started doing minis.
Yep.
Why minis? And yeah, what was the goal with that?
Okay. So the original intention, we wanted to put something else. Wanted we had all these skills we were developing and some great people as well in the business. We wanted to put some more volume through the business, as simple as that. And the Mini was something that you can't.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
See, but I've got two photographs on my wall here, my two heroes. Top one is Roger Daltrey, singer from The Who, and the bottom one is my father. And my father always described the Mini to me, my first car was a Mini, as one of the best engineered cars ever in the world, but one of the most appallingly manufactured at the same time. And so when we were looking at what sort of things, what sort of British cars we could do, we looked at a number, and the Mini just kept jumping out as almost the obvious one to do. We didn't know what the reaction was going to be to the Mini remaster. And I remember the day that we launched it to various press and other interested parties. And it was most people's reaction was something along the lines of, why has no one done this before? And, and that's a great reaction to end up getting, because you just think, yeah. because they haven't. Yeah. And so in that regard, it was almost an obvious choice to do.
And the process for the Mini, I guess, was a very different process for the Speedback. Like, how did you attack that project?
So the essence behind Mini Remastered is that it is fundamentally a restored car. So it's a restoration of an existing car. And we do a superb job of doing that. So it is not a new car in the same way that a Speedback will be classified as a new car. They are always a restored car. So we buy a donor car, and from that donor car, we will remanufacture the engine. So the engine is completely rebuilt. It ends up being a miles better engine than it was. I don't know. You actually look too young to remember that BMW, when they used to build Formula One engines, they would take a 3-litre engine block out of a car that had done 150,000 miles, because that was stress relief. You know, if as long as it hadn't fallen to pieces, that was miles better than a brand new block. And I think in some ways, what we do with Mini Remastered and restoring the engine, rebuilding the engines, is the same thing. And then we take some components we simply have to change. We have to put new components. Others, parts of suspension, things that... So there'd be various bracketry, for example, that we will take off the donor cars. We will glass blast it. It almost shot peens the surface. And have you ever owned a Mini?
No.
Okay. Well, I have. So my first Mini, SBB240M, that was that beautiful orange British Leyland colour. It was vile. But the good thing about the orange colour is the same colour as the rust that the car arrived with.
Nice.
So it disguised it for quite some time. But when you take some of these components, the existing original components from the donor car, and you shot blast them, and the shot glass blasting it, it actually hardens the surface of the metal, the action of doing that. And then, of course, we powder coat them. And you end up with it's still the same thing that came off the donor car, but it looks brand new. And yeah, it is not going to rust like the original car would. So we will nearly always use a new body shell, because a new body shell is quite simply the most cost-effective way of getting to the finish that we want to get to. We've got thousands of hours of work in each one, and a lot of that work is in the making sure that, you would regularly buy a Mini where when you close the door frame hit the side of the car as it was closing, just the way they work. And we will address all that, so we'll get great shut lines, we'll get nice flowing curves where there should be a nice flowing curve. And there's just an enormous amount of work to go from what, people say, well, I can restore a Mini. And yeah, you can do. Everyone can restore the Mini themselves at home. But we do it in a more production and arguably more professional way to get ultimately the finish of the thing at the end of the process.
Yeah, I was actually, I drove the Ocelli edition, which is more of a sort of track orientated, I guess, or just it's got a cage in the back and whatnot and a bit more horsepower for the listeners. But one thing I was amazed, we were driving down the motorway for a little bit, coming back to sort of base, and there was basically no wind noise or very minimal wind noise. I was expecting to be able to hear coming from the outside, like through the windows and stuff. And then I started looking around, and then when we got to the back to base, I had a look and opened and shut the doors and whatever. And yeah, in short, like I was very impressed with, like you said, all of the seals and the way the doors work and fit mean that the outside does not come in when you're driving.
And yeah, I mean, that detail like that just does not happen by accident. And there's a massive amount of work to make it like that, to make the door shut easily. You're still things like the door seals, which people, no one wants to talk about a door seal. I'm going to. A contemporary door seal is made in a completely different way. The Mini door seal, it wouldn't have been, that they started fitting them shortly after they were invented.
Yeah.
Prior to that, it was sort of felt. There wasn't a door seal. So you're still working with some old technology there, but you can still make it nice and you can make it work. And, the problem with the original Minis was the way in which they were manufactured, not the way in which they were designed or engineered in the first instance. So, the seams on the outside of the car, which some people like, and I don't mind them, but they were put there because it was the cheapest way of manufacturing, not because the designer originally intended them to be there.
Yeah, it was very interesting at the factory to wander around because there was a donor car waiting to be, converted.
Yeah.
And you could see it and it had all these seams and stuff, which I don't even, because I've not owned a Mini. And I've not spent too much time around them. I've almost never really noticed the seams.
Yeah.
And then, the massive seams all over the place. And then right next to it was a car that it was undergoing the first bit of the production and it had its new body on it and everything. And you're like, oh my God, this looks so much better. It looks so different, straight away.
Yeah, and I think it's just, it's part of what we set out to do with the car in total. So, we put a new dashboard in there, which has got, as you now know, which has got a sat-nav unit in there. It's got aircon sat in there as well. And all those things help to make it look almost as if it is a brand new car. And certainly you only really see the difference, and it's a massive difference, when, as you've just experienced, when you've got the two sat side by side and you see what was actually in them in the first place. But, you know, again, the mini story I love as well. So there's a car developed in mid to late 50s and designed as a very cheap four-seater family car for everyone to use. And then the 60s comes along, and all the things we talked about earlier apply massively to the Mini at that period of time. So it very often, women started to drive. Women hadn't driven that much before. And as they started to drive, the Mini was, you know, the absolute brilliant first car for them. And then the eldest child, nearly always, got the mother's car handed down to them. So it became the first car in that sense for a load of people. But it also became a fun car. You know, you see the pictures of the Mini in the time, in the 60s, in Carnaby Street with the Beatles driving it. And everybody, you know, it was an inoffensive thing in that regard. Not just inoffensive, it was fun. And fun is what people wanted. And we tried to put that back in as well into the product. So, the 60s drove the Mini into a completely different category that it was ever intended to be in the first place. And had the designers known, Izzy Gonis and his team known that that was going to happen, they might have done it differently. It didn't. You know, they thought, and to a very large extent, it was a competitor to a brilliantly manufactured vehicle, which was the VW Beetle, but an awful bloody thing, and the engine's in the wrong place. It's stupid.
Your point about the dash is, I guess, actually, because the dash must have, the car I saw that was coming in for build, I think was quite an old one, or an older one, and the dash and setup inside just looked pretty much prehistoric. Whereas when you get in one of your cars, it all, like I said, it's all just like, it looks kind of like, not modern, but just nice.
Well, thank you. I'm really proud of that dash. It was a young designer that worked for us who came up with all of that detail. And I think we did an excellent job with that, you know, in terms of when you look at it, you look at the dash within the car as part of the car, it looks as if it's always been there. You know, it doesn't look like some sticky on bit. It looks like it was designed as the original design. So when you see, you know, the lovely leather work on it and the features that it's got within it, the way it ties in color-wise with the exterior of the car, I think it looks superb. I am really proud of that.
Yeah, I thought it was very cool. In fact, and I hadn't looked in like an old Mini for a long time, so I just looked in yours and was like, yeah, that's what it looks like. And then I saw this other one in the workshop and was like, oh no, that's what it looks like before.
Exactly. Like, exactly.
This is different. What were there some of the bits? Were there some of the sort of unexpected challenges with doing the Mini that you didn't expect to run into?
There's lots of unexpected challenges in everything in life. So the fact that the Mini has had its fair share. I'm just trying to think of something that will illustrate the point. I think that there were lots of components that you thought you might be able to buy off the shelf that we can't, that we have to have manufactured especially for us. And that was a bit of a surprise. I think that as we, you know, when we built the first ones, we put slightly different suspension components in. So the molten design rubber bush that's the suspension unit, there were about 25 different variants of that in terms of the mix during the life of the Mini. And then there were people that did motorsport versions, because Minis, and one thing I forgot to mention about the 60s is that they also discovered it was a great rally car. So it was everything car. So there's lots of motorsport related components out there. And if you put those into the Mini, you create something a lot harsher and harder than we were trying to create. So with the Ocelli edition that you drove, that is deliberately a harder car in terms of its drive, but equally it's still not as hard as you could make it, because most of the time people are going to drive it on the road. And you could, you know, you can turn it into a go-kart and give it go-kart-like handling, but that's not going to be that comfortable when you're driving it normally. So I think the other thing that surprised me about the Mini itself is how many different markets it got sold into. You know, absolutely all over the world. So everybody, and it is, again, it's like a mini Speedback in terms of the reaction you get from people, because they love it. And, you know, it's it's an inoffensive thing to own. It doesn't contradict the sort of person that might normally be driving it.
Yeah, absolutely. It was just something I was talking to one of the team about. There's certain cars that you get a certain associated image, but there's also certain cars that just sort of fly through all of that and there is no image of the person. And one of the ones, a new car that I'd say is a bit like that, is like a smart car. Smart for two, you know, the little, that could be driven by anyone and everyone. I don't think some people, the owners love them, but I don't think you look at someone in a smart car and you don't necessarily go, oh, they can't afford another car, or this is their only car, or whatever. It's just they've chosen that car for a reason. And it's like sort of similar sort of thing. Like you see someone driving a Mini and it could be their only car, or it could be their 100th car. Like it fits into all categories of kind of cool.
And that's one of the things that helped it in the 60s. So in the 60s, it was owned by the rich and famous, you know, and it was a cool little car. And today it's, and then it went through a phase of, you know, where lots of other things came out and stole its thunder. But today, you drive that car anywhere and you just get, no one thinks, well, they can't afford anything else. Even if it's not one of our Minis, even if it's, you know, an old knackered thing that someone is just holding together with gaffer tape and string.
yeah, absolutely. And so the car I drove, which was the Ocelli edition, that's a little bit different to the normal Mini remastered. What was the sort of inspiration behind that, and what did you do to
it? That was to build on the Mini's sporting heritage. Ocelli themselves were noted engine tuners from the 60s, you know, been around doing and racing Minis and tuning engines for Minis all that time. The Mini, as I think nearly everyone knows, has a great sporting heritage and it is still today used, you know, on racetracks all over the world because it's a great little car. And so we wanted to give an additional string to our bow in terms of one more variant of the already popular Mini remastered. So it, as I said earlier, it sat on slightly harder suspension. It's got a much more powerful engine. It's also carbureted, and as opposed to fuel injected, and that brings with it its own character and a lovely character as well. You know, I like carbureted cars. And so the sound that goes with the performance is excellent.
Yeah, it's a fun, like, within, it's one of those cars you get in and within like 100 meters, you're like, oh, this is probably going to be quite amusing. I'm going to enjoy this process.
So many people have taught their children to drive on Minis, including our Mini remastered, because they believe that they're actually being taught to drive. And so there's no traction control. There is a predictable element of how it's going to handle without any electronics stepping in to save the day. And if you can drive it, and it is easy to drive, you know, as long as that steering wheel is pointing in the direction you intend to go, you're fine. But you've got nothing to sort it out other than those wheels saying, we're going this way.
Yeah, it's a very pointy and sort of squirty little thing. And it just kind of, you're immediately aware when you're driving that car how small it is relative to other traffic and how much, even just like how much space you have on the road, because it's not that wide. It's like, it is small.
It is. I mean, again, you look at some of today's current Minis, and I'm not just referring to the BMW Minis, I'm referring to, you know, the Fiat 500 and anything in that that claims to be a Mini isn't anymore.
No.
And that's partly legislation that makes it go that way, and partly the creature comforts that people demand out of a normal car.
This is actually something I was talking to, I believe he's an acquaintance of yours, Ian Briggs from BAC. I was chatting to him on Tuesday, and we were talking about the small city car and how none of the small, specifically the Mini was at one of them. It's like none of them are that small anymore. And they now almost don't tick the box of what they were initially intended. And we're sort of starting to see with electric cars and stuff, some new designs come in for interesting small city cars that might have seats in front of each other or, you know, that sort of thing that might fulfill that role again. I think it's sort of an interesting space, but yeah, I want to see more stuff that's essentially just for a person to get round town with not much else, rather than everyone driving their SUVs with seven seats and two people in it.
And I get that massively. You know, there is particularly now with electric powertrains and everything associated with that, there is the opportunity to be revolutionary, if you want to, in terms of how you would design something. Having said that, and again, you're too young for this, but the Sinclair C5 or whatever it was called, you know, the three-wheeler thing that was invented, electric car.
Oh, yeah.
That was marginally dangerous on the basis that it was so small it would get squashed a lot. And yeah. So you've got the balance, I think, between, I think people have just got to reinvent the way we do things. I mean, COVID's been great for letting people see there's a different way of working. And yeah. I don't know how many Zoom calls I've had. I've never had a Zoom call before COVID. And I quite enjoy them, especially when I can put an interesting background on.
Yeah.
But, you know, the same way that I quite like the new Hyundai and the Kia.
Yes.
Because they haven't constrained themselves with some of the design, I think, flaws that some of the other manufacturers have got. You know, they had a fresh look at it and decided there's another way to do this and let's do it that way. So, yeah, there's some fascinating stuff to come out, I think, in the future.
Yeah, I think it's... And one thing we've seen is we've seen a lot of manufacturers come up that are coming at cars that have never made cars before. So they're not, like you said, they're not constrained by, if you're, you know, VW Group or something, you've made God knows how many millions of cars in your lifetime. You have a bit of a, this is how we make cars.
Yeah.
You know, this is what a car should be like. Whereas if you've only made, like, I don't know, some tech or something, and you go, let's make a car, you can start at the whole thing again and go, let's optimize this for what we want. A bit like coming back to the GT car thing, like, yeah, what's this car's purpose? Yeah. And let's design it around that.
And absolutely agree 100% with that. And, you know, that's where I think the car design of the future has got to go. It's got to become a different thing to the thing it is today. But then we will live our life differently as well. So that we will recognize that we have to stop for 20 minutes to charge it on a long journey. So what? You know, we set off 20 minutes earlier and we have a nice cup of coffee and we relax. And I think that there will be, I, fear that I won't live long enough to see the sort of ideas that I think will come as a consequence of the revolution that we will ultimately have. But I know my grandson will live long enough, and I'm pleased it's in that world.
Yeah, it's there's going to be, I think, well, everyone, what's the phrase? I can't remember. It's they overestimate what's going to happen in a year's time, but underestimate what's going to happen in 10 years' time, or, you know, that sort of thing. And it'll be crazy. Are we going to see an electric David Brown Mini
at some point? Not for the time being. We're always looking at things. I think that one of the issues there is that technology moves so very, very quickly. And the, you know, even battery size is coming down all the time. One of the real issues with the Mini is packaging as well. Clearly, there's not a lot of space.
Yes.
But again, properly defining how the car would be used would massively influence how you might do that.
Yeah, if you go, I don't need back seats, and it's just luggage space or something, then you've got a lot more space and whatnot. I think, like you said, the tech is changing so much at the moment that you wouldn't want to necessarily do something and be left behind a year later, unless you can adapt it. You know, whether the power packs can, batteries can be swapped out or whatnot and stuff like that. Yeah, it's an interesting one. I think it's an interesting in space, but at the moment, yeah, driving one of your Minis, that engine is quite a big part of the experience, and it's quite fun.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I love driving. I love driving them all because, I guess, of the sporting background I've got myself in terms of cars. Then the Selly edition is a real bit of fun, and I love it. I want one.
Yeah. Are you going to get one? Have you got one of your Minis?
I've got one of the prototypes we made at the very beginning.
Good times. Right, well, I normally wrap these up with five questions. Are you ready?
I'm ready.
Do you have, we may have briefly covered this, but maybe not, most memorable driving trip or journey?
There's a route across the top of the Andes, and I can't remember the road, but you drive up so high that in an old car, it starts to run out of oxygen and you run out.
Okay, yeah.
And it's absolutely one of the most stunning places I've ever driven. It's where the flamingos at nighttime, it gets so cold up there. At nighttime, the water freezes around their feet. And in the morning, they have to wait for the sun to come up so they can move again.
So, oh, wow.
They're not very clever, those flamingos. But yeah, I mean, I've got a ton of different places I love. I love driving in Scotland, just like the whole thing.
Yeah. When you were in the Andes, what were you driving? Were you driving your AC?
AC, yeah.
Yes. I think whenever I hear of people doing amazing road trips, I've done a couple of fun ones, but I think there's so many amazing ones out there. And I think a lot of people give excuses of, I don't have the right car in the right place and the right whatever. And then you see someone like yourself taking an old car, going to a crazy place. And you're like, okay, you can take any car to these places. It'll be fun. It's the journey, isn't it?
Oh, it's the journey, yeah. And I'm a big believer in enjoying the journey and not just trying to get to the destination.
Yeah. Okay, so if you were planning a road trip, how do you go about doing that time-wise? Do you just go, this is the distance, or how do you allocate the time? Because I think that's quite an interesting...
Well, on the rallies I've talked about, the distance every day is determined because you're on a rally by the hotels, basically, or the accommodation that's booked. So if you've got, like, Peking to Paris, maybe 250 people, they booked a hotel for one night. If you don't get there, you can't get there a day later. On the journeys that I like to do, I don't want to have a destination determined by time. You know, I'd rather just think, this is beautiful. I'm going to stop, smell the roses, and not worry about. So if I'm making my own plan, I like not to have a plan.
And it's, I think everyone, this will resonate with everyone a little bit. There's times when you might be going on a trip somewhere or whatever, and you come across somewhere, a place or something, and you're like, I want another day at least here to go and do this cool thing or whatnot. You're like, no, but you've got to leave in at 9 a.m. tomorrow. You're like, no. And then you're never going to go back. Like, you're never going back to that place.
Yeah, I mean, I can picture 100 of those places. and I have probably never spent enough time anywhere, you know, even though I say I'd like not to have a plan, ultimately I end up having a plan.
Yeah. Yeah. Life does catch up eventually. If you could only drive one car for the rest of your life, what would that be? And you're allowed something that costs £500 on the side.
I would make that decision based on being practical. So if I could only have one car, it would have to be an immensely practical thing. And so if it was, I would have a speed bike.
Fair enough.
But if it couldn't be a car I made myself, it would be the new Defender.
What do you think is the most undervalued car at the moment? What should be worth more than it is?
I happen to think that Jaguar is an undervalued brand in the sense that it produces some stunning cars, but it has a reputation today of being an old man's choice of vehicle. And it shouldn't be.
Yeah.
You know, when I was a child, my dad always drove Jaguars because they were the sporting cars the nation produced in quantity. And so yeah. I suspect that there's a lot of cars like that, that within that range, that if a different badge on would sell for more money or sell more of them. So, yeah, I'd answer it like that.
I agree with you on that one, because up until the F-Type came out, I think for me, I didn't really look at Jaguar. I thought the XKR was kind of cool. But then the F-Type came out and we had all the V8s and the V6s and stuff. It suddenly became a lot more interesting. But I'd still look at the saloon cars and everything like that and be like, this is kind of, it's got an old person's image. But I think that is shifting over time with these as they're sort of, they're competing a bit more and doing more stuff. But yeah, I think that's a good answer to that question. What is the most interesting car to you at the moment?
I think, and it relates back to our previous part of the conversation, that is that I really like the platform that the Hyundai and the Kia electric cars are now going to be based on.
Yeah.
It seems to me to have thrown away a whole host of things that have been in our DNA for the last 100 years of manufacturing. So I think that potentially is where I think those companies will be the ones that drive the modern car forward, not necessarily, and with all due respect, the Mercedes-Benz or or the Audis of this world, etc. You know, it'll be someone that started almost with a clean sheet of paper.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think at the moment we're in this weird transition period of this new tech coming in. And like if I was to buy an electric car in a hypothetical 5 years' time, I could very much see it being from not the people I would have conventionally bought a car from, like Audi, Porsche or someone like that. I could see someone else, like Hyundai or whatever, coming in and just doing something so different with so many cool features and just a different way of doing it that you're like, that's the obvious answer.
Yeah, definitely.
Right, final question. 5-car garage, unlimited value.
What would I have? I'd have my AC.
Yep.
Because I know every nut and bolt on that thing, having tightened it up across the world.
Yeah.
Absolutely, definitely. I would have a speed back.
Yeah.
I would have one of our minis, a mini remastered. Yep. It would, the practical one would be, I've got a Range Rover. And yep. I love that car because you can do anything you want to in it. So I think I'd have one of those or mm-hmm. a Defender. How many have we got so far? Four.
You've got four. So you've got one more slot.
Right. Well, I'm not interested, as I've said earlier, in some silly supercar. So I think that I would have the Hyundai.
Oh.
As representing the future.
Yeah. Yeah, I get that. Have something electric in the garage.
Yeah.
Do something a bit different. When someone asked me this question, someone asked it back to me, a couple of weeks ago, and I was surprised at myself that I had in my five-car garage a small electric car because I live in a city. And I was like, I now, having had one, would not have one.
Would not have one.
Yeah, I will always have a small electric car. I think whatever that looks like, I think from now on in my garage, even though it's as a petrol head, it doesn't necessarily fill an amazing slot, but I think it's an essential part of my garage from time going on now.
Yeah, I think so too. And, I do like new technology, but I also like... And again, the COVID change to our lives have made you think about the world in a different way. And yeah. Everything we can do to help that world, and it will be, with oil boilers produce more smoke in Stuttgart, more pollution in Stuttgart than cars do.
Yes.
And... people have got a real downer on cars as being the cause of a lot of pollution. And it is, that's because people have got a downer on cars sometimes.
Yes, I agree. I think in London, there's stat on, I think it's something like 30% of air pollution is from wood burning, like stoves and wood burners in people's lounges and stuff like that. 30%. I think it's 30%. It's a really, really high number for something that you go like, I wasn't aware that people still, I've got friends that have them because they think they look nice.
Yeah.
But I wasn't aware that people were using them. And I think people are not aware of how bad they are for your health.
But that is actually mainly people burning not dry wood. So that is what produces, it's damp wood that produces the pollution. I think they've banned it, haven't they? Or are they just about to ban the wood with a high moisture content? So you won't be able to burn that anymore.
I think that's definitely part of it. But yeah, it's crazy that it, like you said, it's cars are a part of this, all of this bigger picture. And we have to look at all the bigger picture. I've found doing, like you said, you've done a lot of Zoom calls. I've switched the majority of my podcasts are now recorded over the air, and I try and meet up with people when I can, but most of them are over the air. And I realize how much time I've saved in traveling, which is absolutely insane.
Well, it is. And at the end of the day, we all do something to earn money one way or the other.
Mm.
But the one thing we're really going to run out of is time. And that's almost why I never want to reach the destination when I go on a journey. I don't want to get there.
Yeah, it's over.
It's over.
I think that is a great, great point to wrap up this podcast. Thank you very much for coming on. It's been a pleasure chatting.
No, thank you too, Sam. I've enjoyed it. It's been great.
Thank you. Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Cats and cat owners deserve better than any old-fashioned litter. That's why I teamed up with scientists and veterinarians to create Pretty Litter. Its innovative crystal formula has superior odor control and weighs up to 80% less than clay litter. Pretty Litter even monitors health by changing colors to help detect early signs of potential illness. It's the world's smartest kitty litter.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.